with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
It is Men's Health Week in New Zealand, and who better to have as our guest than a fellow Men's Health Week ambassador, Mike Puru. Mike made his broadcasting debut in 1995. He's had a varied career in both radio and television. These days, you can hear him in the afternoons on the Breeze radio station. Back in 2010, Mike made the decision to publicly tell people he is gay when working on The Edge. It was big news at the time. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about his formative years growing up in the small South Island town of Gore and what it was like to carry a secret as a young man. We get into the biggest challenges of his career, how he deals with the scrutiny of being a public figure, and how he intends to celebrate an upcoming milestone birthday. I'll give you a clue. He's on the other side of 40. I hope you enjoy my chat with Mike Puru. Really appreciate your time on Take It From Us. How do we find you today? How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little under the weather, actually, you know, because I've been darting around the country doing MC gigs. I was at the Gore Gold Guitar Awards over King's birthday weekend, and it's one of those situations where you party a lot because you're catching up with people you only see once a year. But it's really cold in Gore. Being a fellow Gore boy, I'm prepared for it. But they heat the halls really hot, so you sort of go from hot to cold, hot to cold. I think Gore holds the record for the most amount of times I've taken my jacket on and off. But come back and I've got the bug. So, but I'm okay. I'm good. I'm feeling good this week.
You could think of that as a form of contrast therapy. You don't have to worry about the sauna and the ice bath. It's just jacket on, jacket off.
It is like that, honestly. She's a wild weekend, and I love my country music, and I just love the people. So, no, it's good to go back home, because, you know, that's where I'm from. So you go back there, and everyone treats you like royalty, and I'm, like, bewildered by it all. And a lot of people, too, they, you know, they work with your mum and dad over the years, so they always tell you yarns about that, which is quite fun. So it's always a good visit.
Do you enjoy the MC work?
Yeah, I do. I still suffer from performance anxiety. You know, I stand on the side of the stage going, what am I doing? But I do really like it, you know. Whether it's an MC gig or whether it's a concert or a conference, I learn a lot. You know, I learn a lot. I meet some cool people, and I get to introduce some amazing people as well. And I sit back and go, wow, this is cool. It's a good gig, you know. It's a good gig to have, yeah.
Often a thankless one, isn't it, MC work, because someone has to do it, right? Someone has to be the anchor to make sure that everything goes smoothly, but also to add a dash of colour and flavour and some personality too.
Well, yeah, and I guess too, the whole sort of event rides on your shoulders a lot because the organisers can do as much as they can to get everything in place. It's how you bring it to life, I guess. You don't want people even going, that was the most boring conference in the world. And sometimes the subject matters can be, like, I was in Invercargill about a month ago doing the National Planners Institute conference, and that is town planners and people that design towns and stuff. And on paper, you'd think, oh God, this looks like the most boringest thing in the world, but it was absolutely fascinating, and the people in that room were incredible. So, you know, when you're dealing with a lot of data and stuff, yeah, you do try and colour it up. And I was lucky because I'm a Southlander, I could make some Southland jokes. Yeah, I started the conference by going, "Oh, welcome to the Planners Conference here in Southland." Probably about 50 years too late, but never mind. And they all laughed, you know. But only I could say that. Somebody else who wasn't from Southland couldn't started the conference like that, so that got off to a good start. They all had a laugh and away we went.
How has Gore changed since when you grew up there?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing I noticed is Te Reo Māori. Like, I mean, all the schools embrace it, and when we do the gold guitars now, there's always a karakia at the start, and I think, yeah, that's been the biggest change. I think sort of, you know, the blending of some cultures, because when I was there, you know, I was one of the Māori, one of three Māori kids at a very Catholic white school. And, you know, there was always I don't know, you always just felt like you were, you know, an imposter there, really. Especially, you know, when I started sort of doing some things at school. But, you know, look, it's changed a lot in terms of the industry there. You know, the meatworks were a big provider of income. The paper mill was huge. Farming was huge. So, you know, it's certainly changed a little bit there, but it's still surviving and, ticking away there quite nicely. But I think it's become a bit more multicultured, so, which is a good thing. It's good.
Yeah. And of course, you've been very public about your own private story and how things were for you. Being a gay man or learning about yourself in a small town like that, where already you're in a small minority, how was that?
Well, to be honest with you, yeah, it was a little bit tough. And, I think having experienced being gay in Gore and being Māori, you know, ticking all the minority boxes, really, it sort of built a little bit of resilience in me. And it taught me, I guess, to be a bit more prouder of who you are. I think the main problem I had there is that I was scared, you know, and I was also, I had this immense embarrassment too. I didn't want to embarrass my family in a small town like Gore, you know, when you're the gay in the village. I didn't want mum and dad to be the subject of those rumours or that sort of pressure, this weird pressure that probably doesn't exist, but in my head it did. I was a little bit reserved, but probably worried as well that I was never going to be accepted, I guess. But I was just really lucky that in a small place like Gore, you find the right pockets that embrace you for who you are. I mean, I was still in the closet, really. I guess people could see the signs. I mean, I was doing theatre shows and stuff, you know, it was all there, really. The writing was on the wall. But, you know, it was tough. And look, and Mikey Havoc and Newsboy did that TV show, you know, and called Gore Gay Man's Gore. And I'd moved out of Gore and just started my broadcasting career. And again, that was another sort of, you know, mental block for me where I thought it's best to stay silent and not be out and, you know, live my life in secret. So it was an interesting place, but at the same time, I kind of, am appreciative of those pressures that it gave me.
Did you feel supported? Did you have good support network at that time?
Well, no, not really. I guess because I didn't talk about it with anybody. And, you know, to be honest with you, it didn't help because my mum's brother was gay, but she used to make comments all the time, so I didn't really want to say anything to mum and dad, you know, just because, like, oh, God, I'm not coming out as gay here, you know. I basically waited till I moved away. In fact, I waited till I was 34, to be honest, before I revealed to mum and dad that I was gay. But, I guess nowadays there probably is support there, which is great. I mean, schools, are quite good, just like the Māori, I guess, nowadays. But back then, no, there was really nothing, you know. And you felt scared, you felt alone. I was just embarrassed, really. For some unknown reason, which is a really stupid thing to think. You know, not good on your mental health too, because you're trying to, I've always been a believer in finding what you love and go for it. And that was sort of, you know, that whole sort of shrouded in secrecy sexuality thing kind of blocked that a little bit, and that, you know, maybe held me back slightly because I didn't want to be out there so people could judge, I guess. So yeah, that wasn't good, I don't think.
But the embarrassment you felt is really an indictment on our society at the time, more so than you.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I think it was my own perceptions, though. I mean, because, you know, the reality was people didn't care, and people at Gore very, very much, you know, love me today. They don't care. They ask about my partner, and, you know, I can remember going back to the Gold Guitars one year, and I'd come out of the closet publicly on radio, and I was a bit nervous, and, you know, this rough-ass Gore guy who, you know, grew up with the family, kind of, you know, remembered him, was at the pub, and he was like, oh, do you want a beer, mate? And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, trying to be all staunch, you know, I'll have a stubby. One of the first things he did, he's like, oh, so have you found a man yet? Is that easier up in Auckland than it is in Gore? And, you know, just the neat pressure just lifted off my shoulders, and I thought, wow, okay, you know, no one cares. So that was good.
Yeah, that's a really nice story. And it's an encouraging one too, because I guess for you, there's for all of us, when we're young and then of course as we grow up, there's still that pull and that tension between attachment and authenticity. So we want to be ourselves. We want to be true to ourselves, but we also want to fit in. So I imagine for you, you're probably wrestling with both a lot of the time.
Well, yes, especially when you're doing a job which is, you know, on radio and on TV every day and you're going to mine your life for content. That was part of the reason why I didn't want to come out, because I didn't think people would like me. But at the same time, the reason people like you more when you're on radio is because you are authentic. You know, you're right. There was a real pull there. And all the experts from overseas that used to come and, you know, critique our shows would always say to me, oh, you know, just you need to be yourself, mate. You'll be a better broadcaster if you're just you and be honest. They were right at the end of the day, because, you know, from that point on, I just, you know, it's been pretty good, to be honest. You know, I wish I'd done it earlier.
And that you're referring to the, I guess now, famous reveal. I think you might have even called it that at the time in 2010. Well, that was 15 years ago on The Edge. I've seen the video footage of you, and that, I mean, they were filming it back then too. So here you are building up to this momentous moment. You were saying how difficult it was to tell everybody that, yes, I am gay, and it's being filmed. What was that like? The whole moment, the whole build-up to that?
Well, I can remember sort of only making the decision to reveal it, you know, 24 hours prior, to be honest with you, because I, you know, I didn't want it to be a big thing. See, this is the thing, you know, like I guess I didn't want to be defined as the gay broadcaster. That was the other thing, that, you know, because everyone has a thing in their life, don't they, you know, oh, good at rugby, oh, good with girls, oh, you know, clever at school, and I just didn't want to be the gay guy. So I didn't want it to be a big deal, but at the same time, I knew that once I said it, there was no going back. And yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I forgot that they were filming it. Just wanted to say it. There was a sleepless night, really, thinking once I've said it, there's no turning back. And once I actually, you know, my heart was thumping, and once I actually said it out loud and we rolled into a song and life carried on, I remember in the car driving home, and I was just in tears all day. Like, I was worried. I was like, what have I done? I can't undo this. This is the worst thing I've ever done. I, you know, look at me weirdly now. Will I ever get a job in TV? You know, all these things were sort of, you know, even though I'd had a little job in TV, but all these things were running through my mind, and I really wanted to retreat into, you know, my shell and just hide from the world for a while. But emails were a thing back then, you know, internet emails. And all of a sudden, into the Edge inbox just flooded all these emails, and it made me cry for a different reason. It made me cry because I was so relieved, you know. I just was like, I can't believe people were just so supportive and funny about it. Like, you get some funny emails about it. You know, people like, oh, about time, mate. Jesus, the writing was on the wall. And it really did sort of turn that whole scared about revealing my sexuality into something really positive. And that has continued to this day, actually.
You've probably influenced a heck of a lot of others.
Well, I don't know if I've... potentially, yes, because I do get those emails. But I think what was more important for me were the stories of the parents that would say to me years down the track, you know, they were obviously youngish and listening to The Edge, and they hear that and they know who you are, and they sort of, you know, listen every day. So, you know, they just kind of grow up with you, I guess. And then they have kids, and, you know, they say to me, oh, because I listened to you coming out on the radio, it was far easier for me to hear it from my kids when they told me. Or you get the emails from people that say, because we were all in the car listening, it gave me the courage to tell my parents later. And that's one thing I absolutely love about it. And to this day, I still get people coming up and saying thank you, you know, just saying, hey, look, you're right, John. You know, maybe it did influence a few people. And I guess at the time it was lost on me how important that was. And that was one of the great benefactors of that announcement, I think. It was pretty cool. Because, you know, makes you feel good because you go, well, I was struggling, came out, but now the ripple effect was other people felt more comfortable. And, hopefully it did sort of influence society's thoughts a little bit on that. You know, because it's tough when you're a male in New Zealand in the closet, I would imagine, especially back then. Now I think it's a lot easier, you know. But, you know, I always was worried that guys would, you know, potentially self-harm or want to leave this world because of not feeling accepted. And the fact that I had to publicly announce my sexuality and then it was publicly accepted was hopefully a sign that society was ready to deal with anything, you know? I think, I hope.
Yeah. Well, I was a sports broadcaster for a long time, and every now and then the topic of homosexuality in sport would bubble to the surface. And I knew it would be difficult. I knew it would be edgy. I knew that it would make people feel uncomfortable, but I felt a responsibility as a talk announcer to deal with these issues and to have a mature conversation and to seek a mature feedback from callers and listeners. And often we would have people who would say, talk about the choice of gay people, that it's a choice, it's a lifestyle, all of these sorts of things. And some of it was ignorance and some of it was willful ignorance. And my pushback always was, if you know how hard it is for them and you know how mentally this is draining and exhausting, they can't be themselves, who would choose that for themselves, right? To be treated like a second-class citizen. Who would choose that?
You're so right, and because that was something I would say all the time, you know, when people go, oh, you know, it's a choice, and I'm like, God, no, it's not. Do you think I've chosen, you know, to make my parents feel embarrassed, or chosen to feel judged? And you know, I basically would say to people, if I could take a straight pill tomorrow, I would, you know, which is a really sad thing to say, you know, because it's not a choice. And I think that was, you know, the thing that I loved about dealing with my parents, you know, because they were just so good. You know, I was worried the other thing that ran through my mind is that, you know, kids, I don't have kids, but I assume that kids are a reflection of, you know, of your mum and dad and your upbringing. So publicly, you know, you're always, I guess, you're always waiting for your kids to do something that shows that they are your kids, and whether that's good or bad comes with, you know, I guess a little bit of stress. But you know, I hope that Dad didn't think that it was anything he did as a father that made me gay, because I wanted him to understand that it is, you know, just something that you are born with and you have to deal with, and you know, you. Yeah, nowadays it's easy, but I think it's a lot easier nowadays. But back then, you know, it's not something you choose. And sexuality is a very, very interesting topic, isn't it? Because, I mean, nowadays, there's so much fluidity in the world that people don't have to make announcements about whether they're gay or not. In fact, people would roll their eyes if you came out and said, oh, I'm gay, you know, no one would care. You know, and I've always said too, I guess we'd be in a good place when an All Black comes out. And, you know, I guess we've had that in the last couple of years with the former All Black coming out. No one batted an eyelid. And before you know it, he's on the cover of the Women's Day with his partner getting married.
Yeah, you're talking about Campbell Johnston, the former All Black's prop. Really, though, the massive breakthrough moment will be when a current player,
that's right,
is gay, with the pressure of performance and the pressure of being in that moment. And we're not quite there yet, eh?
No, we're definitely not. No, because I mean, kudos to Campbell. Yes, you're right. But I think, yes, when a current player who is playing in the team wearing that jersey comes out, and look, there's, you know, I mean, maybe through pure coincidence, there has never been a gay All Black playing for the All Blacks. A gay rugby player, but maybe through pure coincidence, that has just been the case. But I suspect it's not, and one day that will happen. But I mean, I think we're dead. We're getting way better.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and it might seem like a hell of a responsibility for that one person to be the first and everything that comes with that. But I would like to think that New Zealand's ready for that moment and that would actually move on pretty bloody quickly.
But I think we are, you know. Like, I mean, Men's Health Week, right? I mean, you and I are ambassadors for Men's Health Week, and I know that a lot of your work over the years has been on the mental health side of things. I think men in this country have struggled to expose their feelings, and I think we're at a point now where that is a lot easier for men to do, and it's important. And, you know, you and I have probably seen that over the years, being ambassadors for Men's Health Week, that conversation is starting. Because, you know, sometimes I worry about about guys, because I'm like, God, they're just so stoic and take everything on their shoulders, and they don't want to complain, and they, you know, they run around being dads and being workers and being, you know, just trying to be good blokes in society. And sometimes there's a lot of internal struggles, but they never want to talk about it because it's a sign of weakness. And, you know, thankfully, I think that is starting to shift. Would you agree?
Totally. I think it is shifting. Yeah, because vulnerability builds trust. And if you're prepared to be vulnerable, this is the great thing with your story, is because you were prepared to be vulnerable in front of a mass audience, the overwhelming feeling would be, well, he's a hero. He's helping people. And, oh, if it's okay for Mike to talk about it, it's okay for me. I've seen this many, many times. And it's that classic Kiwi mentality. You've got a big group of guys. We're out there in packs. We're a bunch of mates. We like our footy. We go to the pub, all this sort of stuff. One guy is the first to say, hey, fellas, I'm struggling. Hey, is there something I need to talk about? And it gives everyone else permission to do it.
That's so right, you know. Like, I mean, because the rock radio station, I think, have been great ambassadors and sort of bringing that to the forefront in a macho environment, you know. I mean, it's all blokey on the rock. And they've done tremendous work, I think. Yeah, so John Kerwin, he's been quite good at that. But I only think it's in the last couple of years that men's stories, thanks to people like you, have actually been heard a little more. And that ripple effect is continuing. But Wayne Langford, I don't know if you've ever spoken to him, from President of Federated Farmers.
No, I haven't.
No, look, when I was doing that panelist conference in Invercargill, he was one of the speakers there, and I've never actually heard his story. I thought he was just going to talk about how great farming was. But he, you know, like, his story is quite heartbreaking. You know, he had this big farm, he had a lovely family, he had everything going on, and he was bottling everything up to the point that, you know, he was out, you know, he wanted to give up, and he couldn't do it anymore. And since he's sort of opened up about it and he's found the right support, you know, he's flourished and he's managed to find this beautiful balance where he still, you know, still struggles and still has, you know, some bad days. But he shares that story. And while he was telling everybody in that room, I could feel everybody go, shit, I did not expect this to be coming out of Wayne Langford's mouth. And, you know, he was very emotional about telling the story. But I was just thinking how powerful it was that he was vulnerable, that he was sharing, and that he was affecting a lot of other people. And, you know, even the wives in the room, you know, the partners that, you know, could go home after that conversation and just check in, I thought was really good. And, you know, I love the fact that, you know, back in the, was it 2010, you know, for gay blokes, for blokes that were struggling with sexuality, maybe there was a little hint that I was chucking them a bone and going, hey, look, it's all okay. My life and career has survived. It's, you know, it's way down the chain of things that people attribute to me now, and it doesn't define who I am. And it's a lot easier living your life in truth than it is hiding it. Honestly, it's a lot nicer. You know,
did that free you up after that moment in 2010? Did that free you up as a broadcaster to be yourself, so that you actually could be the broadcaster that the experts had told you to be?
Well, no, you're right. It's exactly what happened. It did. It freed me up immensely. You know, I could talk about my life in a much more open way, which then people could relate to, you know, straight or gay. It was just, you know, me not having to dart around the word partner, you know. I was always scared to say he, so I'd always use they. And, you know, just all my pronouns were up the yin-yang, so I couldn't actually convey how I was feeling and living my life in a sort of comfortable manner, you know. But also just going out and about doing things, you know, living life. Going to weddings, going to parties, going to a concert, going to a restaurant, you know, all of a sudden, that just didn't become an issue for me anymore. Didn't care, you know? It's funny, isn't it? It's funny how as you get older, you start realizing that you worry a lot about things that probably don't matter.
but you've also been in the public eye now for a long time. How have you handled the scrutiny and the judgment that comes with just being a broadcaster? Because I'm a fellow broadcaster, and We are judged every single time we open our mouths and we present every single time. And I know what the text machine can be like and some of the stuff that comes through. I know so many broadcasters that deal with these things in different ways. How have you dealt with the judgment and the scrutiny that has come with your life?
Well, I guess I first just kind of said to myself, it doesn't matter. But that's it's a funny thing because when you are a broadcaster, actually it does matter. So, you know, I don't know. I found that quite hard. But I tell you what I've noticed, though, which gave me great comfort, especially in the last sort of 5 years, like what you and I do for jobs over the years, putting yourself out there broadcasting, you got to watch everything you say. And with the advent of Twitter and, you know, Instagram and Facebook, all of a sudden you started seeing people saying things and then getting lambasted for it or getting cancelled or, you know, appearing to have to deal with what they had said out loud into a public forum. And I'll be like, well, see, there you go. You know, you are getting judged by what you are saying online right now because you've put it out there. So, you know, have a stop and think about what you're saying before you put it out there and understand that as broadcasters, that's what we do every day. So, you know, I guess it made me realise that everyone who has an Instagram account or a Twitter account, especially back in the early days of Twitter, you know, people would make statements and everyone would be like, can't believe you said that. And then it made me realise that we are quite lucky, I guess, to have the platforms that we have, but also that the reaction to what you're saying is always going to be there. So I guess I've just tried to be nice and kind. I hate to use Dame Jacinda Ardern's phrase, but, you know, I've just hoped the whole time that I'm nice and kind so that the comments and the scrutiny that I come under don't affect me so much. And look, when I did The Bachelor on TV, the comments weren't so much about my performance. It was just about how short I was on a little chair and how lazy I was just turning up to a rose ceremony, handing out roses. They never really criticised my performance, I don't think. So, you know, I don't know. I guess I've just learned to deal with it by going, well, look, I have an opportunity. They chose me. I'm doing it. If you don't like it, don't listen. But I've been quite lucky that, you know, I haven't had too much negative stuff. I don't try to read it too much.
And people think you work a three-hour day and they won't give you the credit for all of the preparation that goes into the show, right?
Oh, yeah, God, yeah, you know what it's like. You know what it's like, mate. Like when I was doing the weather, you know, you do 4 minutes on TV3 weather, people just think you turn up and read it. But I'm like, no, it took 4 hours to write that. Well, then they'll blame you for the weather. But, you know, I don't know. Part of this job is, and I accepted it, that you are going to have conversations with people and sometimes they will talk to you about things they don't like or things that they do like. And I just go, oh, yeah, I'm lucky, you know, I get to have the conversation. And if it's a negative conversation, I try and spin it around and I just use that as part of a skill set and enhancing my career, really. I'm like, oh, well, cool. Diffuse that situation, we move on to the next, you know. And it's just part and parcel of it. Yeah, I chose a job in radio and TV. I just have to deal with it. But, you know, I don't, you know, I go for a run if I, you know, I'm feeling really stressed about it. Maybe, you know, I talk to my partner about it a little bit. But, you know, he doesn't care, to be honest. But he's a sounding board. So, yeah, that's scrutiny. Yeah, and I think for mental health, you've got to offload sometimes. But I think for me personally, I've just realised I'm a very resilient person and it just kind of rolls off me. I'm just like, I don't care. I'm having a good time. Stuff you.
Well, you and I are a very similar age and I'm starting to feel a bit more that way too now. And someone said this to me very recently that apparently the magic number for not giving a shit about what other people think of you is about 43 years old. And I thought, oh, yeah, that might be about right. And I know this is not the case for everybody, but there is a little tipping point, isn't there, where as you start to age, you do think, you know, I just want to be myself. I want to be comfortable in who I am. And I know that not everyone's going to like me or think what I do is good, so stuff it. I'm okay with that. And I kind of feel that's where I am now. You're turning 50. You've got the big milestone birthday not far, just around the corner. Does that give you pause for thought at all?
Yes, Ken, actually, yes. Thanks.
I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah. No, and I'm embracing it. I am trying to embrace it. I always look at my body going, I wish I'd been to the gym a lot earlier. You know, and I'm starting to get those aches and pains that happen when you get to your 50s. And I, you know, having gone through the whole sexuality thing publicly and sort of understanding then that what people thought probably shouldn't have affected me so much. I'm surprised it's taken me to this point where I've gone, well, I need to reapply that rule because, you know, I guess in the last, even just in the last year, I don't know what it is. I just have gone, I just do not care anymore. I think I've always set out to try and prove points, you know. I think when you're Māori and Goa and when you're gay and, you know, and when you're a broadcaster as well, you're always trying to prove that, you know, you are good enough to be there. And I guess people in any job are like that, you know. Are you good enough? Have you done enough? But I've reached the ripe old age of 49, coming up to 50, and to be honest, I'm quite content now. I'm like, cool, I've done it. I've done a bit of radio, I've done a bit of TV, I've had a really great career, I've got a lovely partner, you know, I've got a roof over my head, got some good friends, and I've got nothing more to prove, and I'm like, oh, it's quite a nice place to be when you're content.
Well, contentment, we're all
here anymore. You're like, yeah. I mean, I still do care, don't get me wrong, I do care, because I want to be a professional, but externally, about me personally and my life, I'm just, yeah, I should embrace it more. So that's why I'm going to have a big 50th. I'm going to embrace it.
Yeah, you're starting to plan it now.
Starting to plan it. Kent, you're on the list. Yeah, man.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be...
Oh, no, I am. No more. Well, I was actually planning it, which is pretty exciting, you know, because the partner really doesn't care too much about the broadcasting realm, really, which is kind of a good thing. But all of a sudden, the partner's gone, oh, you know, you're 50, it's a milestone, you need to embrace that. And I'm more like, oh, no, I just want a few drinks with my mates. He's like, nah, have a party, man, you're 50. You made it. And I'm like, okay, cool, let's do it.
Oh, no, and the thing about broadcasting is that the people that you get to work with are so passionate. They're passionate, they're talented, and overwhelmingly are very good people and extremely supportive. I always found that, for want of a better word, the brotherhood, the camaraderie is the better word, right? The camaraderie in broadcasting was just so alluring. But it was also nice to get yourself out of there for a while, and I imagine to have a partner who's not part of that world has been really good for you. Would that be right?
Oh, you know, definitely. You know, I guess too, because it kind of keeps you a little bit grounded. Otherwise, it can get, you know, the broadcasting can get a little bit intense. Because when I worked with JJ and Don, the one thing that I found frustrating was that, and maybe it was good for our career and we did really well, but, you know, they were a married couple and they were hungry for success and it just consumed them all the time, you know. It was like there wasn't a life outside of work. And I think as I went on, I realized that it's important to have that, you know. You've got to have a life outside of work. And although broadcasting is a reflection of your own life and thoughts, it doesn't have to be 24/7. So, yeah, to have a partner who just doesn't care at all. You know, I'd say, oh, I'm up for a radio award or something. And they'd be like, oh, that's cool. You know, anyway, you know, where are we going this weekend? I really appreciate that. Just
well, if you ask most people, if you were to say to someone, hey, tell me about yourself, the first thing they will say is what they do for a job, because that's how they identify. But often it's really special when you actually have talked to someone who tells you about them, the person. Because you're a broadcaster, but that's not you. But you're more than that, right?
No, and interestingly enough, the partner didn't actually, well, he claims he doesn't know. I didn't actually know that I did radio and TV when we first met. So that was quite nice. And, you know, and I love it too. I love it when people ask me what I do for a job. I'm like, oh yes, I can just, you know, have this conversation. I always try and flip it on to them because, you know, sometimes in broadcasting, especially if you've done TV, you find you're talking about yourself a lot because they're quite curious, you know, they ask questions. What's Mike McRoberts like? What's Sam like? Oh, do you still keep in touch with JJ and John? You find yourself, you know, talking about your own world, and I always try and flip it after 5 minutes because I don't see my partner sometimes looking at me going, shut up, you're talking about your job again, shut up. So I've learned to flip it the other way. eye and go, well, you know, what about you? What do you do? And try and make them feel good too about it, you know. Because for some unknown reason, my partner sometimes feels like he hasn't achieved because, you know, he works as a barista and manages a cafe and he's not, you know, he feels that that isn't a career. And I'm like, well, yes, that is a career. A coffee's big business, mate.
It is. It's an honorable profession. I feel a little sad when women say, oh, I'm just a stay-at-home mum. And I'm hey, man, there's no just about it. You've got to talk yourself up. I've been a stay-at-home dad during COVID. I know what it's like to be a parent at home with kids. It's bloody hard. There's no just about it.
No, that word just, you're right. They do say that. Oh, I just work at the warehouse. Yeah, you are working, and you know, if you work at the warehouse and you're just on the tills there, before you know it, you could be CEO in 5 years. You don't know. Don't say just. Yeah, you're right. But you know, that's my whole. What I've realised, Ken, is that life is bloody hard. You know, and I know two ways about it. Life is tough, and I've been very fortunate and privileged over the years to be in some amazing experiences and some amazing jobs. And you know, I watch people go through all sorts of different things on the sidelines, and they're just trying to get ahead and be themselves in life. And I guess radio and television, you have the opportunity to tick that box quite nicely because, you know, you're getting judged constantly by an audience. But, you know, I just want people to realize that life is hard, but, you know, we're all in it together, and that, you know, cool, you're going to experience some ups and downs, but it doesn't matter where you're at financially, where you're at career-wise, where you're at in your relationship, what sexuality you are, that all does not matter because it's all stuff that we can work through, that the world, New Zealand in particular, New Zealanders, I think, are quite good at that. We're quite good at picking people up and going, okay, cool, what do we need for you to have a happy life? And that's all I want. I just want people to have a happy life, you know? And it's you know, sometimes I find it a little frustrating that, yeah, there's a lot of focus on, you know, all the stuff that's gone wrong. And I'm like, you know, we just make people feel good. The world will be a better place.
Amen to that. Mike, it's been lovely to chat to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Take It From Us.
Thank you, Kent.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story. Our story.
Never miss your favourite shows again. Click onto planetaudio.org.nz.
Hey Stephen, what are you doing at 8 p.m. on Sunday night?
Well Emma, like you, I'm tuning in to Kick Arts on Planet FM.
Well, who would want to miss it?
Kick Arts, Aotearoa's one-stop shop for all things art, entertainment, theatre, events, books and more.
Join us as we chat with fabulous guests, mix with some great Kiwi music and lots of laughs.
Kick Arts every Sunday at 8 p.m. here on Planet FM.
Hello, kia ora my friend, I'm Susie Cato, inviting you to join me for New Zealand's favourite kids show on Planet FM. It's called Susie and Friends, and there's songs, stories and prizes, jokes, reviews, birthdays and shout-outs, and kids just like you. Go to susie.co.nz for more information. I'd love you to be a friend, just listen to the radio Sunday afternoons at 3:15 for Susie and Friends on Planet FM 104.6. Susie and Friends.
I like and love Auckland because it's very green and it's very natural. I live here from the last long time, so I love it.
Loving Auckland.
I just love our community, but I love Auckland for its buzz.
I love Auckland for its buzz.
It's a playground out there.
The thing that I really like is the cultural diversity, the many languages, and the enrichment through all the different cultures, faiths. I think that's fascinating.
104.6 Planet FM. Our diversity.
Take It From Us brings you real stories from real people, sharing their experiences of mental distress and journeys to recovery. Tune in next Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. right here on 104.6 Planet FM, or catch the latest episodes at planetaudio.org.nz/takeitfromus. It's a half hour of commercial-free music coming up next now here on Planet FM, taking us through to Samleng Khmer with news, music and updates from Cambodia on air at 2:10.